Good morning again. Your shoes are even drier. Wonderful. I often wondered in this organization for the past 40 years why we didn't have a session like this before. Of course, it's some, in respects, a soul-searching operation. And one reason for this is a presentation that was made in 2009 in Washington, D.C. by Leah Beale. It was her video of collectors. I remember watching these gentlemen, all 5 years younger than they are now, amidst their Fafnerish collections and wondering, well, what's going to happen? We know what's going to happen eventually, but what's going to happen to the stuff that's surrounding them? And maybe that's not all that's surrounding them, but it's certainly a lot of stuff. So anyway, this session is intended to begin a process of thinking about what happens to your stuff. And what happens to your stuff, not just for yourself, but for those near to you, partners, institutions, sons, daughters, whoever. Because the collection will certainly survive you. Nonetheless, I want to begin with an epigram. It's not from Ecclesiastes. It's from another, more contemporary book. And I'll read it and then give you the name of the author, the book, and then we'll introduce our panel. Quote, you spend 7 or 8 decades, could be, acquiring your objects, arranging them, dusting them, insuring them. Then you walk out with nothing at all, as bare as the day you arrived. That's something to think about. But anyway, on a brighter note, let's move on to our panel. I'm going to start with two members, Tar Heel members, in fact, who we're proud and privileged to have joining us today. The first gentleman immediately to my left is John Hubbard, JD, attorney at law. He's a specialist in security cases and expert on variable annuities, but he's appearing with us today partly because he's a very good friend of John Lambert, whom I will introduce in a minute, but he will be talking about estate planning as it relates to objects. Any kind of objects, but in particular objects that we collect. The second person I want to introduce is my good friend John Lambert. John and I have known each other since 1967. We are both graduates of this distinguished university. I graduated twice, once with a library degree, second with a library degree, first with a BA. John and I have known each other quite a long time, and I'm very proud and happy that he is here with as the other Tar Heel representative. The further panel members, do they require an introduction? I will introduce them anyway, just in case. Steve, in the yellow shirt in the middle, has been a member of the Music Library Association since 1961. From 1969 through 72, he operated Cards for Records, a service for libraries. In his role on this panel, as the appraiser person, although some of these titles may vary or be duplicated by others, we're a little fluid here. He was a founding member of this association. Since 1962, he's been a recording engineer involved in the emerging field of audio preservation from its beginnings, acts as a dealer in old recordings, and from 1975 has served as an appraiser of sound recordings. To his left is Kurt Nauck. Who doesn't know Kurt? Raise your hand. Okay. Kurt, you're well known. It's usually say known to the authorities, but yes, good. And to his left is David Sorbert. David wanted to be introduced as the head of special collections at USSB, but many of you might know him as someone who does collect records on a large scale. Number one, number two is superintending an excellent and expanding website of discographic information on American sound recordings. So, we had a little meeting the other night about how to proceed since we have a quintet of a panel. So we thought we might start by having a brief presentation by each of our panel members. By brief presentation, we mean it. And in case they go over, we're going to give them a a healthy round of applause and move on to the next person. Thank you. There are other sounds on this little machine, but they're not they're not nearly appropriate. Well, they might be.
They might be, yeah.
You know, we can have an audition of this. This is recorded sound, right? Okay? Right. So without further ado, I want to start with John. I think maybe, John, you can come up here. Is that okay?
I could do that, or I could sit.
Okay. Whatever and, whatever you choose.
And we can relegate you, okay. Michael, to the background.
Thank you. Excellent.
Are we going to use this?
Yes.
Song? Hello?
Switch on.
The on-off switch.
Keep turning.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. Welcome to North Carolina. Denial is a river in Egypt, as everyone is aware. It's not a viable solution to the question of what you're going to do with your stuff when the time comes. Although most of us, I think, certainly when we're starting out, don't tend to think very much about that. I speak as a collector who in 1969, courtesy of Uncle Sam, went to Vietnam and then took a little side trip to Hong Kong with a friend of mine from the ship who later built the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the $92 million fisheye museum. We had some interesting people on the ship. And with him went to visit a Hong Kong art dealer. The art dealer revealed many beautiful Asian artworks, many of which Jack Lane ended up buying. But during the course of this display, the dealer turned to me and he said, "You collector?" And I said, "Not of visual art." In fact, I had at that point been collecting records in a very serious way for 12 years, having started at the age of 12 with the Toscanini Otello, in which was a little catalog from RCA of all the Toscanini records that they had at the time, which immediately I decided I had to go get. It was helpful to have worked with and known Mike Gray during the university period. Mike, I think, more than any other person that I know, has single-handedly established the scientific method of collecting through the establishment of his incredible series of discographies. You know, we live in the best of times and the worst of times now when, with the internet, we can find almost anything anywhere in the world, and we can find each other, people who care as we do about collecting. But it's roadmaps such as Michael has established for us in so many different sections of musical research that make it all possible to make sure you really have found everything. So it was with this background and with the inquiry from the guy from the art dealer in Hong Kong that I began 45 years ago really to think about where does this stuff go. And I'm still thinking about it. And all of us who are private collectors, I think at some point need to confront the reality that we ain't taking this stuff with us. And if we care about what we've invested so much of our time and resources and emotion in amassing, then we need to think seriously about where it goes. The problem is that there are fewer and fewer places to send it. We're going to address that in just a minute. Fewer and fewer places that will take it. Quite frankly, fewer and fewer people who share our interests to the passionate degree that we do. And so this is the challenge that we want to talk about some today to try to encourage particularly private collectors to begin thinking about if you haven't already. And with that, I pass the baton to who? Michael.
At this point, we have presented the problem. And now we're going to present some potential solutions. At least they should be potential solutions, because I don't think anybody here wants the dumpster to be a solution. Perhaps some spouses might, but certainly not anybody. Certainly not anybody who's actually invested their time, and especially their emotion in some cases, in developing a collection. So at this point, we have a problem, which is what to do with it, and we're going to pass the problem on to a person who can tell you something about it, who is the appraiser. And that person is in the person of Mr. Steve Smolian, who is next on our list.
Good morning. This is a very somewhat structured presentation. Question one, when you are considering what to do with your stuff, is to figure out the people who may want it, and then figure out among those people, with interaction among them, who is going to be the winner, if such it be, of your materials. What I'm going to talk about is more, at this point, the constraints, the things you have to think about as the material is in progress from your possession to that of some institution, or whether the institution be for educational purposes or for reselling what you will be passing on. When you're donating, any restriction, such as having it the collection named after you, reduces its value substantially for tax deduction purposes. But when you're considering a tax deduction, the primary question is whether it will actually benefit you or your estate. And that's something I assume you'll be speaking to. But it's an important consideration, because the idea of paying money for something you or your heirs then cannot use is a waste of money for everybody except the appraiser who gets paid. So you should be aware that the IRS frowns upon you creating any conditions for attached to a gift. Now, if the institution makes the first move and says, well, we would be glad to name the building after you, you can say, well, that's fine. But especially in this age of email, you have to be very cautious when you are discussing this in whatever format you're discussing it with potential holders of your material. Very seldom will it be kept together as a unit by the new owner. Your carefully constructed collection will duplicate in great part what the receiving organization already has, so that there's no point in them making yet another room with just your stuff in it. There are exceptions to that, but they're primarily for collections that are interested in the history of a particular person and what the influences were on that person, and that they keep everything together to show that this person had come onto my house and so did that person, and this was an influence on how they developed as performers or lawyers or whatever. The value of the collection is something that an appraiser cannot tell you beforehand, of course, but an experienced appraiser can give you a picture of more or less what the fair market value will be, and I won't go into that particular definition at this moment, to give you some idea of whether you're better off taking the $5,000 or just under $5,000 as a tax deduction that your collection does not require a professional appraisal for, or whether it pays for the appraiser to for you to have an appraisal so that the appraiser isn't the only one who benefits from it. Catalog. Almost never does the cataloging you've done meet the standards of the institution that you may be donating to, but it is helpful both to the institution to have a finding aid, or for that matter, to a dealer who may be considering your collection to have a paper picture or a screen picture of what he's otherwise looking at as a series of vertical lines with records sometimes contained in the little pockets that those lines represent. If the collection is well organized, the appraiser can actually give an additional value for that to the, add that to the value of the fair market value. Many institutions want money with the collection. I'm not calling it resources, I'm calling it money, which is what resources means, in order to process the collection, and will give, when faced with the same options, will give priority to accepting a collection that includes some processing money with it. Be aware of that. The question of moving it from where it is to where it's going is something that both the institution and, for that matter, a dealer has to consider when coming up with a value to them, whether you pay for the shipping or the institution pays for the shipping, or when you are negotiating with a dealer, that the dealer has to bear in mind what his shipping costs are, what his storage costs are at the other end, and that is a discount in his mind to what you'll be receiving, or the offer you'll be receiving. How are we doing on time?
You got another minute.
Okay. The concept of self-created works is one other issue I wanted to get into, which is that if these are tapes that you recorded, you are entitled to the value of the materials only. You cannot take off any extra added value for what the content is. That includes recording Metropolitan Opera broadcasts off the radio, recording bluegrass concerts, whatever your particular interest is, you simply are not entitled to take any more than the cost of the materials. And there are publications, federal publications, that go into great detail on this. They are publication 561, 526. I have a little card outside on the table that has these numbers on it. You can actually download them and print them out for yourself. They go into great detail on this. I'll go into no further great detail, but pass it on to whoever the next person is in this line.
Well, we're starting to get a Venn diagram here. We've got the collector, and we have the appraiser. Now we come to the next steps. Who it might go to? Well, we have two representatives here on the panel. First, we're going to go to Kurt. Kurt is the one person who might want to take some of your collection, and we'll let Kurt tell you if he wants it.
Well, tell me what you've got. A dealer actually fulfills kind of the role of an appraiser in an unofficial way, because oftentimes I'll go into a home or a building or a barn or somewhere and thoroughly evaluate a collection and sort out good stuff from bad stuff and the gold from the dross and make an offer, and I leave empty-handed, having just presented a very fine appraisal to the owner of that collection. So that's fine. I mean, that's part of the business. We understand that not everything is going to come our way, and I have a very realistic point of view. There's always another collection around the corner. There's no hard feelings or anything. That's fine. Certainly that person has no idea what the offer is going to be, and if it doesn't live up to their expectations or desires and they have other avenues to investigate, that's not a problem at all. But generally speaking, a collector has basically a couple of ideas in mind, or may have a couple of ideas in mind in terms of the disposition of their collection. Number one would be a legacy factor. I've spent my life building this collection of things. It's important to me. I feel like it's probably important perhaps to someone else. You know, I don't know of anybody else who's collected a complete set of whatever it might be. And I think that this needs to be preserved. And I think it needs to be understood and perhaps researched and archived somewhere. And that's understandable. I certainly have those feelings about some of the things that I've assembled over the years. And I know that many of you do as well. And if you can find an institution who would agree with that assessment, then that's potentially a very good thing. And if that's your only consideration and remuneration doesn't enter into that equation, then someone like David or others might agree with you and say, yeah, we'll give that a home. And so that's a win-win for everyone. That's not often going to be the case, however. Your collection of whatever it might be is likely going to duplicate the potential recipient of that collection to a very large degree. You know, David's not going to all of a sudden decide, well, I want to collect this because you did, and I don't have any, so I'll keep it all. If he's interested in your collection at all, it's probably because that's one of the areas that his collection focuses on, and so he's probably already got 80% of it. So he's only going to be interested in a small percentage, perhaps, of what you have. So, so the other thing that you're going to be considering as a potential decollector is the remunerative aspect. You know, I would like to get some money for this because I'm not going to be able to donate it, at least all of it, to an interested institution. And that remuneration can come in the form of cash, which is generally what I will pay, or it could be a tax write-off of some sort or another. Maybe not to an institution, but maybe to an organization like Salvation Army or Goodwill or any appropriate charitable organization that might be willing to take these recordings and dispose of them however they see fit. And that is indeed a legitimate avenue, and it does occur. David Canfield, who is a member or was a member of this organization, I don't know if he still is, works with his local symphony orchestra in Bloomington, and they have a big record sale, and he'll accept records for that, which they will in turn sell and raise money for their organization. So that does happen. So usually in the experience that I most frequently encounter when I'm dealing with collectors and collections, it's going to be a combination. Everybody would like to find the final solution for their collection, and that be a one-shot deal. You know, you're going to take everything, whether you're an institution or a dealer or whatever. And that's sometimes possible. If you've got a collection that will, you know, fill 10 milk crates, that's not so big a deal. If you've got a collection that fills 10 rooms, that's an entirely different situation. And that's not at all an uncommon situation. I go all over the place where the whole house is just totally full of records, and everybody in this room has seen those situations, if you're not living in one. So in that situation, I'm not going to take everything. I can't afford to haul all that stuff off. You're going to pay somebody to pull most of that out of there, unfortunately, probably. But I will go through, and I'll pull out the things that are of value. Unlike virtually any other dealer I know of, I deal in everything in terms of vintage recordings, and I define that as being basically from 1890 through the 1950s, not including any sort of LP, 45, microgroove sort of stuff. So if I go through a collection of vintage recordings, I'll go through your diamond discs, your cylinders, your 78s, your radio transcriptions, and once I've made my pass, you can be pretty well assured that there's not going to be a whole lot of value left. And so if we can make a deal on the stuff that I've cherry-picked, if you want to call it that, then that's great. Then you're left with a bunch of stuff that nobody's going to want, unless, you know, you have individual persons come in and they want to go pick through it for their collections, which is fine. But in terms of getting rid of this house full of stuff, you're going to have a very hard time. You throw it on eBay, and you may or may not get any takers at all. And if they do, they're probably not going to want to clear out your house either. So what do you do with this? Well, if you can find that charitable organization to take your stuff, there is a tax write-off for which you'll get more benefit than you would get if you were able to find somebody to buy it. And the lawyer on our panel can speak to this, and I'm certainly no authority. Is it my time, Mike? Yeah, I see you're getting
30 seconds.
You got the applause button ready?
The member from Texas has 30 additional seconds.
Okay. All right. Well, I will. We'll be talking later, so if there's any issues or questions come up, I will address them.
Thank you.
And here you go, Mike.
Kurt is providing the cold water in this session. And next is David. David may want to take your stuff, too, maybe.
Good morning. That was pretty cold water. Yeah, I hope my water's a little bit warmer, but we'll see. Excuse the formality of my remarks, but I did want to write it out so I could cover everything in the allotted time, and we'll have time for a discussion, and I hope, after. But if you have a collection and are interested in the preservation of these recordings, there are really any number of institutions in the country that share your passion and enthusiasm. A lot of them are here at ARSC. But the key to finding a home for your collection is to understand how libraries and archives work and determine which ones are likely to accept your donation. There are many factors that we consider when deciding whether or not to accept a donation. We all have our specialties, whether it's by format, by topic, era, or other factors, and we're unlikely to accept outside of those areas unless somebody's collection is perfect for a new program we're developing or something like that. Some examples would be things like cylinder collections, archives that are devoted to radio or jazz, collections that are focused on 78 RPM discs, things like that, or field recordings, as in the ethnomusicology archives. Each institution also has its own capacity for the size of collections it can accept based on staffing and funding and that sort of thing, and we have to consider the costs of preservation and cataloging as well, and as Steve alluded to. And if your collection is very large, it really may not be a good fit for any single institution, and it's tough to consider breaking up your collection, but if you're interested in its preservation, that may be the most smart thing to do. You know, maybe the 78s go one place, the LPs go another, the CDs someplace else, something like that. And, you know, you can't hang on to your collection until the bitter end. And your family may not want it either. So I would recommend really planning this out in advance, and I think our attorney will address this as well. But be sure to put your wishes in your will or your estate plan. You know, I've seen cases where this didn't happen. And once the person dies and, you know, if it's in the courts or whatever, the family can often, you know, lose control of what happens. So if you want your collection to go to an institution, make sure that's specified in your planning. As Steve also said, financial support to offset shipping, cataloging, and other expenses make your collection much more attractive to an archive. And if you don't provide for this, the estate executor may not even be able to designate funds from the estate to ship the collection to its new home. Alternatively, if you'd rather have a dealer come and spread your treasures out to the world of other collectors, remember that they probably won't take everything, as Kurt just said, and your family will still be left with the remnants to dispose of, now much less valuable and interesting because the collection has been picked over. And if you're unsure what you want to do, don't let somebody pick through your collection. A picked-over collection can be almost impossible to find a home for. And for that matter, certain formats and types of materials are very difficult to find homes for, at least today, two of these being LP collections and also 78 RPM album sets. But some of the things that make a collection attractive to an institution would be how well the collection complements what the institution already has, the extent to which the collection duplicates existing holdings, the rarity of the materials, and things, as Steve mentioned, you know, things like an inventory or catalog. It's true that your catalog is essentially useless to us as a catalog, but it is useful to us in terms of making a determination of what's in the collection. And that's often difficult to do without an inventory. So some kind of inventory is very helpful. And getting into money, there are very few collections that have significant monetary value, and there are many more that have some rarities of value. Donors and families may initially be interested in selling these rather than making a donation. But remember, great library collections are often made up of donated collections, and the money from selling may not be, in fact, be greater than the sum of the possible tax benefits and the psychological rewards of contributing to a library or archive. If you're trying to sell your collection, understand that unless you sell to other collectors, you're going to be selling the collection at wholesale prices, not at retail. As an example, let's say a dealer will offer you a certain percentage of the collection's value so that they can make money by reselling it to somebody else. This is the price that sets the sale price of the collection, not the appraisal value of the individual items at retail. So its value for tax purposes is the retail price of the individual items, but the sale price as a collection to a dealer or an archive is set by the wholesale prices the dealer would pay, since nobody else is going to pay more than that. If you want to realize retail prices for your collection, then you need to become a dealer yourself and sell the individual items one at a time on eBay or elsewhere. There are certain small, specialized collections that may sell closer to retail value, but in general, large collections won't sell for anywhere close to the retail value. And Kirk can address that if he agrees or disagrees with that. If you're interested in making a donation, the tax advantage for making the donation may be larger than this wholesale price that you would achieve from a dealer. Let's say you're in the 28% tax bracket. Maybe that's optimistic, but you know, 15, 25, 28, whatever it is. It's a pretty standard tax bracket. So the dealer will need to make you an offer of at least 28% of the appraised value of the collection for you to come out ahead by selling rather than donating. You may think that this would certainly happen, but I wouldn't bet on it. Shop around, compare dealer offers and the tax values as a deduction. And remember that the tax deduction is real money in your pocket, and it's not warm fuzzies. And there are warm fuzzies. I mean, if you make a donation, you may get a parking permit at the local university, you may get invitations to special events and private functions, and the collection may bear your name if it's a significant collection. And to close, let me just use a kind of a real made-up example for this kind of retail, wholesale kind of scenario that I'm talking about. Let's say you've spent 3 decades collecting a choice collection of 1,000 early black wax cylinders is your thing, since that's kind of my thing too. Some of them were worth about $6, and some of them were worth a bit more, and maybe a couple of them are worth a few hundred. All told, the collection might appraise out to $10,000 or $15,000. It doesn't really matter what the value is, but let's just pick that as an arbitrary value. So if you're in this 28% tax bracket and the appraisal costs you $300, and I don't know what the appraisal costs you, but I'm just picking a number, and let's say the appraisal comes out at $15,000. When you pay your taxes, you'll end up with a $15,000 tax deduction, which would translate into a $4,200 off your tax bill. So that's real money that you're getting. Minus the appraisal fee, you're going to be ahead $3,900. So if the dealer doesn't offer you $3,900 for that collection, then you're better off donating. If the dealer offers you more than $3,800, you're going to get more money by selling it than donating. But then you have to consider those psychic and intangible things as well. Do you want the collection to go to an archive, be publicly accessible? Do you want your collection back out in the wild again, where it can go to other collectors to enjoy? So those are the kind of the trade-offs you need to make. But I think we need to keep in mind this sort of retail wholesale thing here, because you know the appraised value of the collection is not what it would sell for to anybody that has money to buy it. But in closing, plan ahead. Don't leave the burden of finding a home for your collection to your family and friends. It's a big burden, and I've seen situations that are not pretty. So, and the collection's too important for you to leave it in limbo. So start talking to archives, dealers, and get some sense and put it in writing. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Estate planning. Estate planning. That's what it says right here. So we're going to hear from, John is going to stand because he has a lapel mic. We're going to hear from John a little bit more fulsomely than our other panel members, because we get to hear from them all the time. You know, I mean, But John has 6 points, I believe, that you're going to talk about, and we should all listen, regardless of what we collect, even if we don't collect. Estate planning, we need to do it. All right, thank you. John, great. You have the floor.
The real reason I'm standing is lawyers can't talk sitting down. I've never been able to, but anyway, I've been asked to. I was called the other day. John called me the other day and said that the told me a little bit about your group, and he wanted me to talk about the estate planning that I've done. I've been an estate planner for about 40 years, and he said, "Can you hone it down and talk about collections?" And indeed, I can, because over the years, I don't think there's a year that goes by that I don't have two or three folks come in for estate planning, and they come in with some of the oddest collections in the whole wide world. And over the years, I've learned some very basic rules and some observations, and that's what I'm going to share with you in the short time that I have with you. I have 7 little rules or observations I'll give you. They come purely from an estate planner, so I'm coming from that perspective. To give you an idea, I'll just share one with you. I had a gentleman come into my office one day, and he wanted to do some estate planning. He was carrying a box in his lap, which is not all that unusual. And so we're chatting, and as we get into the estate plan, I start asking about his assets. And one of the things I have on my checklist is, do you have any collections? And he said, yes. He said, that's why I'm here. And he kind of patted his box. And so anyway, I said, well, what have you got in the box? And he starts opening up the box, and as he's opening the box, he's telling me about the 8 or 9 trips that he had taken down the Amazon. And once he gets the box open, he grabs the side of it and spills it over on my desk, and 12 shrunken heads fall out on my desk. And he starts asking the same questions we ask when we have recordings and things like that. You know, what are the values? The IRS was interested in that one. We value 12 shrunken heads. Who can we give them to? They're very valuable to him. I asked him what his wife thought of them, and we need not even get into that. So you can begin to understand that we get a lot of collections, and I have had record collections, I have had musical collections, cameras, I've had electrical equipment, recording equipment, but the 7 rules that I've come up with that I'll share with you apply to all collections across the board, and to the extent that I can think of cases that I've had in this area, I'll share them with you, but I think these 7 rules do apply to everybody in here. The first rule, and I don't think any of these rules are ones that you have not confronted. In other words, I'm not going to give you a rule that that you're not aware of. And the very first one is one that has already been alluded to earlier, and it has not escaped anybody in this room, and that is your collection, whatever it might be, is not nearly as valuable to other people as it is to you. And what I mean by that is the further you get away from your spouse, it geometrically gets worse. Think about it. You think your collection is the greatest thing in the world. Your spouse thinks it's okay only because you like it. But once it gets beyond the spouse and we start talking about nephews, nieces, sons, daughters, brother-in-laws, whatever, the further we get out there, geometrically the value and the importance of that collection drops dramatically. And if you don't do something ahead of time, as far as estate planning is concerned, your collection that is so valuable, either economically or for sentimental reasons or whatever, by the time it gets 3 or 4 folks out there, all of a sudden this thing will wind up out at the flea market with a 50-cent price tag on it. So we need to keep that in mind. And I've had, again, one of the examples that I recall was the guy that died. And he had in his house, when he died, I don't know how the wife ever put up with it, but when he died, he had almost 40 animal heads of animals that he had shot over the years hunting in Africa and wherever he hunted. And by the time he died, they're very important to him, but the minute he died, what did his wife think of these things? Not a whole lot. They were boxed up very quickly, and then they became part of the probate estate. And then people started saying, look, I'd rather have some of these stocks and bonds. I don't want the animal heads. And all of a sudden, these things got relegated to someone's basement. And I imagine that's where they are today. And so we have this geometrical progression. The second rule I have down here is the Field Museum in Chicago does not want your fossil collection. What I mean by that, and it's one that I've had with a lot of clients, and that is you may have a collection that's very important to you, and it may be a collection that might be important to a small group of folks that you might deal with in the community. But you've got to be very careful when you're looking to place this thing with an institution. If you call the Field Museum up and tell them you've got a nice fossil collection, I actually did have that case. I had a guy that had a fossil collection that was worth $15,000. But again, I told him, I said, do not call the Field Museum up in Chicago and tell them that you want to work something out with them, because they have a fossil collection that might be a little bit better than yours. The point I'm trying to make is if you have a nice fossil collection or whatever kind of collection you have, you have to be careful where you're going to place this thing. That fossil collection might be very, very attractive to a community college in the biology department or something like that. Don't waste your time calling the Field Museum up. The third rule I have is be very careful of hidden cost. And that's already been alluded to by one of our speakers this morning, and that is you may have something that is valuable in the form of a collection. And in the back of your mind, you might be thinking, maybe this has some value or maybe I can get some money out of it. But you've also got to take into consideration, if someone was willing to take that collection from you, what is the cost of getting it from point A to point B? As an estate planner, I have found some hidden costs that a lot of people are not aware of. I'll just give you one example. Many states, and North Carolina happens to be one of them, many, many states today have what we call summary administration. It's just a fancy way of saying when a spouse dies, that estate can be administered very, very quickly. In North Carolina, we can handle an estate in about 3 weeks max, and the total cost is $300. In other words, if the husband dies on the first of the month, by the 15th or the 20th of the month, the wife has the entire estate. The total cost is $300, and the estate's closed. The problem with that is one of the rules in order to get summary administration is that if you have a collection and you give that collection to someone other than your spouse, which is what we usually want to do, you cannot get summary administration. We had a case once where a guy had a very small collection. It was coins that were minted here in North Carolina by independent minters back in about the 1870s. And it was only worth about $10,000, and he wanted to give them to the museum here in North Carolina, and they were tickled to take them. They were great coins, worth about $10,000, but he waited until he died to put that in his will. And by putting that in his will, he was not eligible for summary administration. His estate had to go through the whole probate process. It took 10 months and cost him $15,000, or his estate, $15,000. So the entire value of his collection went to attorney's fees simply because he happened to leave that in his will, which is usually not something that we want to do. Number four on my list, and it's already been alluded to this morning by one of the speakers, be very, very careful of putting any restrictions on a collection. I've had clients come in. I had a client come in once. He had a collection. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he had typed up this long list of things. He said, if we find a museum that will take these things, I want to do the fine. He had 17 things down there. Number two on the list was at least once a quarter, his collection had to be the focal exhibit at the museum, and that his name had to appear there, contributed by so-and-so, and that he had to be notified 30 days in advance so he could help all of his friends there to see this. And I'm here to tell you, I've dealt with institutions when we get them to the point where they say, well, we might come out and take a look at it, and we might take it. All it takes, and I'm deadly serious, all it takes is for you to come back and say, could you put a little card in the window with my name on it, just saying I contributed these things, and that's enough for them to come back and say, we're not interested. The general rule out there is if you're going to give something to an institution, museum, what have you, it better be without condition. In other words, an out-and-out gift. The minute you start putting restrictions on it, not only can you run into tax problems, but a lot of these institutions will flatly come back and say, we're just not interested. They have other people that are contributing the same types of collections without restrictions. So they're not really interested in talking to you about restrictions. Your collection isn't worth what you think it is. And what I mean by that is it can actually cut both ways. And in my office, I've seen that happen. The two cases I remember were, one was the woman that came in, and we were doing estate planning. I said, do you have any collections? And she says, oh, yes. She said, I have a collection. I said, what is its value? She said, I think it's somewhere around $50,000. And I said, what is it? She said, I have every single Beanie Baby ever made. Well, we have a little bit of a problem with that. Maybe at one time when these things first came out, they might have had a value. Today, I see them at the flea market for 15 cents. No one wants Beanie Babies, but this woman was fully convinced they were worth $50,000, and she would have several institutions fighting over them, and it's just simply not going to happen. It also cuts the other way, and I need to remind you of that. I had a gentleman die here in Raleigh not too long ago, and his wife was cleaning out the garage, and in the corner of the garage were four or five. I went out to see them, and I'm here to tell you, I agreed with her 100%. These were four or five of the ugliest jugs I've ever seen in my life. They were just about that tall, about that big around. Some of them had facial features on them, but these things were so homely. The woman asked me, she said, what do you think we ought to do with those? And I was very tempted to say, toss them. But being a probate attorney and erring on the side of caution, I said, why don't you get an appraiser out here and take a look at these things? And lo and behold, the appraiser came out. He took one look at them. It took him 10 seconds to say, oh, my God, those are pots that were thrown by. And he threw out the guy's name. He was a famous artist. And these things turned out to be worth $3,000 or $4,000 a piece, and there were half a dozen of them. So pots both ways. I think the rule there is, the rule that you need to take with you is, people in your family need to know about appraisers. The other case I remember is a gentleman died and the wife was going through a spare bedroom that he kind of used as an office. And underneath the bed, she pulled out a soft drink carton that was filled with baseball cards. And she decided that the next time they had a little yard sale that she would put them out there. And she put them out there, and some guy came by and offered her $50 for them. She thought she had hit the lottery and sold them until one of the nephews came home from college and asked about the baseball card collection. It was worth just short of $20,000. Again, you probably, if you do not know something about baseball cards or musical instruments or recordings, your family needs to know. At least leave them a letter. Please have this appraised. Or what have you, because it can cut both ways. You need to have somebody that is an expert in the area. You also have to understand that whatever your collection is, it may have an educational value, it may have a research value, and that's very important. Sometimes these things only have an economic value. The case that I recall, I had a guy in my office once that had a autograph collection of every major statesman in North Carolina, every governor and everything. What research value does that have? None. What historical value does it have? Virtually none. Does it have an economic value? Yeah. To an autograph collector, he might be able to sell those things. But they really were leaning more towards, you know, what can I get for them economically, but they didn't have any value otherwise. Shortly after that, I had a guy come in my office, and he opened up a portfolio he had. He had five handwritten letters there from Civil War generals that were talking about tactical assaults and stuff like that. Those things not only have an economic value, but historically, when we took them over to UNC and showed them to the folks over there, they went crazy over that stuff. It's got research value, it's got educational value, and so you need to know which way these things are going. My sixth little rule I have down here is consider splitting your collection. Rather than trying to take the entire thing and trying to get it to one buyer, to one institution, in the long run you might be better off breaking it up, and you will have a better chance of placing it and a better chance of maybe coming out ahead economically. The one case I recall is I had a gentleman that had a collection. His collection, by the way, was military uniforms from the Revolutionary War all the way up to the Mideast. He had them from Vietnam, he had them from Korea, and all of them were in very good shape. And we started contacting a few of the military museums, and we had a list of all the uniforms, and we were getting a lot of what I call rejection letters. They were coming back saying, well, we're really not interested. And then all of a sudden it dawned on us that to call up the Confederate Museum in Richmond and tell them that you have uniforms from the Revolutionary War through the Mideast, that's why we weren't getting a whole lot of response. The next letter we sent out just simply cataloged the uniforms for the Civil War. And 2 days later, we had somebody from the museum come down to take a look at them, and they were very interested in taking them. The next thing we did is we contacted the World War II Museum in New Orleans and did the same thing, and they were up there. They were very interested in taking that portion of the uniforms, and eventually we were able to get rid of them. If I had to give one piece of advice, and every once in a while I have somebody ask when we're talking about collections, they always come back and say, as a probate lawyer, what is the one piece of advice that you would give? And having done this for 40 years, I'll share with you my piece of advice, and that is, and it's going to sound rather strange, but I think I can back it up, and that is, if you have a collection, think very, very seriously about doing something with it before you die. And I'll tell you why. If you've got a collection and you're 78 years old and you've spent all your life building up this wonderful collection, if you do something with it before you die, there are some tremendous benefits. Now, there are tax benefits. I think one of the biggest benefits of doing that is you know what the value of this is. You can sit down and work with appraisers. You can see this stuff properly placed somewhere so other people can enjoy it. You know that it's not going to wind up out at the flea market. You essentially have complete control over the thing. If you decide to hang on to it until the Grim Reaper comes and gets you, everything goes downhill after that. The value of this thing goes downhill. No one knows what the real value is. We talked about the geometrical decline in the interest in this stuff, and it winds up out in the flea market. So there are a lot of advantages to thinking about donating this stuff, giving it, selling it, whatever, prior to death, because you control the thing completely. And you're able to, by using that control, really accomplish a great deal. One of the worst things you can do, and I've had it happen in my office before, I had a woman come into my office one day. Her husband had a stamp and a coin collection. This thing was valued at nearly $1 million. Stamp and coin collection. She was a retired doctor, died, and she brought his will in. And I'm reading the will, and there's a provision in the will that talks about his coin collection. And again, he sets up a trust in his will. Probably the absolute worst thing you do, because if you're setting up a trust, you're already assuming what? That somebody wants this stuff. He actually named a couple of organizations that he thought would take this stuff, and ultimately down the road they wanted some of it, but not all of it. And then we ran into valuation problems and things such as that. But his trust just went on about what they could do with it, and how often they had to exhibit and stuff like that. And pretty soon, no one was really interested in that stuff, and was eventually sold off for its value and then distributed among family members. So where that collection is today, I don't know. It's scattered all over the country. But I think this guy would have been much better off prior to death for him to have done something with that. Okay. At that point, those are all seven of my rules. I'm going to stop. Now, I'm not going anywhere. If you have any questions afterwards, I'll be wandering around. I'll be tickled to talk to you. And if you have any questions for the panel, I'll be up there. I'm glad to address them. But thanks for listening to me. Appreciate it.
Good. I want to show of hands here. How many have any shrunken heads? How many have animal heads? How many have coins? How many have Beanie Babies? Nobody? Come on. Okay. So we have 25 minutes left. So there are several alternatives here. By the way, thank you so much for all of our participants on this panel. I am really pleased. Thank you so much. So we have two choices in the remaining time. One is questions from the floor. Two are comments to and from members of the panel. So, Who wants to start? Any questions? Yes. Do we have a microphone, please?
While you're waiting, I have a comment to make.
Do we have a microphone for the hallway here?
I can try
shouting. Shouting's good. We can be heard.
Testing.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. We'll wait for Steve for just a sec. We have another comment from the floor. We're good. Now we have a microphone.
Part of it is that we record the sessions, and so it's easier. But yes, so I just wanted to, again, second, and maybe there's a question in here, but think of it, your family and the loved ones and maybe the ones who you don't like, but whoever is left behind, because I tell you what, there's a thing called grief, and when you are dealing with, you know, all this stuff, and if you've been planning for a person to pass, but sometimes not, that there's so much going on that is why things end up in a dumpster. Or I'm telling you, I mean, on personal experience, when my stepfather passed away, my stepsister was in charge of, you know, cleaning the house, and they're trying to sell it and all this sort of thing. And she just ended up, she was overwhelmed the way she dealt with her grief, was she just wanted it to go away, and she didn't think of how to benefit from, you know, we live in a college town, and she could have, like, sold it to college people. But no, brought in a big old dumpster. All of it went in there. So do think, I mean, of your loved ones. It's more than just, some folks even have the wherewithal to think of calling, but when you're overwhelmed, it can be overwhelmed.
The ones who call me generally want desperately to do the right thing. They know how much the collection meant to the person who collected it, and that means a great deal to them, and they want to do the right thing, but they don't understand the collection at all. And they don't even understand how the collection was inventoried or cataloged, if that was what it was. They often don't even have those kinds of materials anymore because the house has been disturbed in the way those kinds of things don't exist anymore. So, I mean, it's not because they don't want to do the right thing. It's just because they are in such panic, usually, by the time that we get called in. So I'm just trying to say the planning ahead is absolutely the right way, but I'm just saying put time into the equation because it takes time. That was my point, and I wanted to say it into the microphone. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve had a comment, I think.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that came up in the conversation. one which needs clarifying pretty quickly. People refer to selling or donating or giving to the Salvation Army or to an institution. There is a provision in the tax regulations which says the receiving is in order to get the full fair market value, that is the retail price, item by item within your collection, which you can do, the receiving institution has to hold that collection for its chartered purpose, which is usually education, for a minimum of 3 years. When you give it to the Salvation Army, they sell it as quickly as they can. In that case, even if you've had an appraisal made of its full fair market value and you fill out the Form 8283 and file it with your taxes, which is the procedure, the receiving institution, if it sells it off in or disposes of it in fewer than 3 years, they sell it at whatever the normal retail price is in their, within their book sale or whatever, 50 cents, a dollar, whatever it may be. And if you've had that stuff appraised at $10 or $15, they are legally required to refile a Form 8282, which says we had to reduce this to this figure, and then the IRS is legally entitled to come back to you and charge you for the difference in how that affects your taxes and penalties. You don't want to do that. You have to be really careful when you're giving to the local Salvation Army. I suggest taking a picture of what they're selling the stuff for with a sign that may be on the wall and hold up today's newspaper or something like that, and it's part of the picture. And that's what you can take off your taxes for that donation. You have to be very cautious when you do give to an institution that is going to surplus a lot of your collection, even if they accept it all, to be sure that they don't surplus it before the time they're legally required to hold it, or they are in the soup the same way. It's a tricky proposition. Usually nothing happens, but you really don't want to leave yourself vulnerable to that.
Steve, thank you. Tim?
A question for David. What do institutions think, and you can speak for all institutions everywhere if you'd like.
Of course.
What do institutions generally think of a collector who wants to make an arrangement with a institution prior to his death, obviously, for that institution to receive his materials upon his passing, but he or she maintains control of them until that time?
Personally, I would be totally open to that, and I think a lot of institutions would be as well. But as John, our attorney, mentioned, there's complications there that I was, like with the trust situation, that I wasn't even aware of. So I think it would definitely have to be worked out between, you know, we would have to get the university's legal counsel involved to make sure that whatever arrangement was set up was agreeable to both parties and didn't end up in some kind of limbo with unacceptable conditions or no costs or no provision for transport or something like that.
Have you done that?
No. Collections that have come were promised, but to my knowledge, they weren't, specified in the will or whatever for that sort of thing.
Any further comments? Yes. One and two.
And I would make one more regarding the restrictions on collections. For every rule, I guess there's an exception, and I'll make an exception. If John Tefteller's here and wants to make a donation with lots of restrictions, come see me afterwards.
Okay, good. Yeah, we see this is useful.
It's extremely useful. In terms of, I'm from the National Recording Preservation Foundation. In the interest of getting this out to a general public beyond our own circle here, would it be possible to get something of a detailed summary of these points, which then we can perhaps provide some links for further examination? Because we get approached a lot by people with collections as well. It would be great to find a more public way of circulating this so that people in these positions, both the estates and people with collections before they pass, can think about it.
We have a panel, so, and the panel promises.
You've got it?
Yes.
These are the IRS publications that give the general outlines of what the situation is.
Yes, for appraisals.
Yeah.
But more generally...
Can we circulate this? For example, can we put it on our website? And
Sure. The IRS won't charge you.
Yeah. But I was thinking beyond the IRS, just, for example, David's evaluation of retail versus
Correct.
Tax value, these points about estate planning and all the rest.
That's right. I think what we'll do is get I have their email addresses, and I'm really assiduous because I'm retired. We have another question from the floor, and then John. Alex. What do you do for the... We're recording this. It's the recorded sound outfit here.
I have a big mouth, is what I was trying to say. I cry uncontrollably sometimes when I think about the money that I spent on the collection that I have. And wanting to be up with technology at the time, most of that ended up being CDs. And it's in specific areas of music history. It's beautifully cataloged. It looks wonderful on my walls. I love it. But I cry uncontrollably when I think about what streaming music is doing to the value of all of those collections, because libraries increasingly are voting to subscribe to a streaming service and leave the selection of box cantatas to the streaming and not be bothered with the physical space that they can use for other things. Is a comment from anyone on the panel about that?
I'm not sure there's a comment specifically, but I know John Lambert wanted to say something.
Well, the answer is basically that material changes value over time. And just because you spend something for it at a particular time doesn't mean it's going to retain that value, no matter what the salesman may have said when you bought your new car.
But I will add that yesterday in our wonderful presentation on digitization of archives, some of this was addressed. I mean, if your recording of Beecham's whatever is important to you, digitize it so it doesn't get lost in the stream, inundated by the stream. I was just going to say that I think one of the biggest challenges that all of us collectors face is inertia. And to come back to my opening statement, denial of the inevitable. I had a little health episode about 8 years ago that slammed me upside the head and got my attention in a big way, and it has made me begin to think seriously about the disposition of my own collection, in which I have invested so much time, energy, resources. It's very important to me. It's important to me in a sort of obsessive, compulsive way, if you want to look at it. I mean, why else would we try to get every Cantelli recording or every 1908 Destin record in an opera set, other than obsession and compulsion? We care, but most others don't. So it's incumbent upon us as the collectors to do as this panel has so eloquently stated in so many different ways this morning, and think seriously about how we're going to dispose of this stuff before the time comes. And you never know.
Further questions? Yes, we have.
Gene Deanna at the Library of Congress.
Okay. Well,
and it was just mentioned, in addition to systematically cataloging your collection, systematically digitizing, especially the fragile materials, magnetic tapes in your collection, cylinders, things like that, will certainly add value to it for the institution that's going to take it and have to preserve it. So that's another additional incentive for your collection to go to a large institution if you can contribute also preservation quality digital files for particularly the fragile stuff.
Thank you.
Mike, can I throw a little more cold water on right quick?
Keep it up. We had it all yesterday. We have some more today.
In terms of cataloging your collection, a lot of people contact me and say, well, you know, should I do that, or I'm in the process of doing that, and so forth. And generally speaking, I strongly discourage it, because most people will spend months, if not years, down there typing up what's in the collection, which I could tell them within a half an hour whether or not they've got anything worthwhile at all. If you have a collection which is not cataloged and you either want to sell it or donate it, first, if you don't already know, get an idea of whether or not anybody's going to be interested in that regardless before you waste incalculable hours doing that, because it's very seldom does a typewritten inventory or a database affect my decision as to whether or not I'm interested in your collection. A general idea may make the difference as to whether or not I swing by your place on a buying trip or fly out to take a look at it. That's very helpful. I definitely need to know something. But unless the catalog already exists, if you're a spouse or a widow or a family trying to sell an estate, I really discourage that, because you're going to be sorely disappointed in most cases. And the other thing I wanted to mention briefly on a previous comment was this. Most people, everybody's got a hobby, they've got an interest. You may be a hunter, you may enjoy playing sports. You spend money and you spend time in your life doing things. And those people don't expect to be to get anything monetary at the end of their life for all the softball games they participated in or the trophy heads hanging on their wall. This is what they enjoy doing. And I think philosophically speaking, for collectors, this is what you enjoy doing. For me, it's genetic. I'm a collector just like most of us are. I understand that. I think most collectors understand that they're not going to see a profit at the end of the day from what they've collected unless they're really buying with that in mind. So the whole idea, the whole concept of the legacy or what I'm going to make may not be that important to you. But as people have said earlier, whatever is important to you, do convey that to your spouse and your family, and do assist them in any way possible to make those arrangements upon your demise.
We're going to have about 10 minutes. We want to let John Huggard close, but we're going to have a couple more questions first. Very short.
Hi. As a spouse who sat with a couple collectors this morning that don't have inventories, and being an organized person myself, as a dealer, you may not want an inventory, but the institutions do need something to compare. And, you know, I've wondered what the quickest way to do, you know, do you make a list of catalog numbers? Do you just say they have these composers? And I would think, as someone said, it's not enough to see the IRS publication. I would love to see some kind of concise summary of these points that I could wave in my husband's face and say, by the way, I won't say any more than that.
Besides, take out the garbage?
That's never been a problem.
Good for him. All right. Time for two more short questions.
Could I?
A and B.
I just wanted to mention that there are so many of these conventions and gatherings now that involve nostalgia, collecting old-time radio, just a whole bunch of these conventions. A great majority of people are Stone Age, like myself, but there's always a few young people that go to these things, and they would be probably more than willing to take your collection off your hands if you talk to them before you demise. I've already found somebody who's he's in his 40s. His wife is going to go along with it. He's going to build a small addition to the back of his house to house my record collection. So I've already taken care of it, and I have no worries that it's going to go to somebody who will appreciate it, and it'll be his problem next as to how to get rid of it.
Yeah, good. Thank you. We have one really quick question and one comment, and then we're going to close.
Hi, thanks, everyone. My name is Jonathan Heim, the curator of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives at New York Public Library. This is a huge topic for anyone who works in archives. I just wanted to do two quick things. One, to Tim's comment, there are a lot of people who do have foresight to do estate planning and will include an institution in a bequest. But what would be even, I think, more productive and helpful for everyone is to let the institution know that you have included them in the bequest. because with great seriously, because if we have a chance to work with you, it can be a lot more rewarding, a lot more productive. And at least in some place like New York City, I mean, in the last 2 months, I've been in the same now vacant apartment or home just as the folks from the Metropolitan Opera were leaving. And I know we, as kind of informal, you know, members of a consortium, would be happy to work with one another too. If I know what the folks, well, I know what the folks at the Met are looking for. I know what the folks, you know, NYU are looking for. Whatever, we can also be a resource to help match things up. But if you put into your bequest, I leave these things to the Met, these things to NYPL, these things to Columbia, it may no longer be in sync with the types of collecting we're doing. So work with us in advance so we can help guide you through that, and everyone, I think, will benefit more greatly. The other thing I would say, there's definitely a need for a kind of concise document. Those of us who work at a public institution are not in a position to advise about taxes, for example, so we can't really give that information. So if you know, we could all work on that together, that'd be great.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes left, but in fact, this is a state known for preachers. Billy Graham, among others, still around. We have one more part. We're going to belay that. We're going to go back. That's a Navy term. Thank you. I was in the Army. You know, I don't know. We're going to have a closing, a closing comment from John Huggard, who is our most distinguished guest, I think, although we have many distinguished people here, to close out, to remind you one more time to plan ahead. Okay, John, thank
you. Good. I've been given 5 minutes to tell you everything you need to know about probate, wills, estates, and trusts. So see if I can do it for you real quickly. First thing I'll tell you is that's very important is that across the country, 65% of the adults do not have a valid will. I do this for a living, I'm telling you right now, 65% of the people in this room do not have a valid will. I always ask people, why are you waiting? I get answers like, it's expensive. I've never understood that. You'll spend your entire life building up these assets that can run $1, $2, $3 million, your collection and everything else, and you won't sit down with an attorney and do some estate planning that might cost you $1,000 to control all of this property. So again, wills can be very, very important. Another reason I have a lot of people think that estate planning is only for older people. I cannot tell you the number of times in a given month I have somebody call me up and they say, Mr. Huggard, we need to bring your uncle by to do some estate planning. We set up an appointment. The car pulls up front. The young couple gets out, and they help their uncle out. Their uncle gets out, and he's on a walker. He's 97 years old. He's just been told by his physician that he won't be around next month, and so now it's time to do some estate planning. There's not a thing in the world we can do for somebody like that. There's just simply nothing we can do for them. The best estate planning that can be done is when you're 50, 55, and then you update that. Probably the single worst thing that can possibly happen to anybody in this area is not to do a will. Again, that's 65% of you out there, because then you fall into kind of a default position that's created by our legislature, and that should scare you to death right there. Every state is different, but I'll give you just one case that I had several years ago to show you how it works. I had a husband and wife, lived in Virginia Beach. They had been in the retail business for 35 years, and one day got up and decided they were going to sell everything they owned, and they sold their house, their car, the recreational vehicle, boat, everything. Got in their car, came to Cary, North Carolina. They had $900,000. The husband put it in a 30-day CD with the idea of seeing an estate planner and a financial planner, and they just delayed. He then died unexpectedly playing golf, and we have this rather large estate out there. The woman then comes to my office, and when she came in, she brought a letter in, and it was from a lawyer out in Denver. And the letter said, Dear Mrs. Smith, pursuant to North Carolina General Statute, please send us $450,000 within the next 10 days, or we'll file suit against you. She's now in my office wanting to know what's going on. And I had to explain to this woman that when a husband dies and there are no children, which was this case, there is no will. Our legislature in North Carolina, very similar to other legislatures, has the property pass half to the surviving spouse and half to the parents of the decedent. This particular case, these people had not talked to each other. The husband did not talk with his father. There's bad blood there. He even told his wife that his dad was dead, and they hadn't talked to each other for 25 years. And now this woman's got to give up half of her estate simply because the husband didn't take a few minutes to go in and have a will done. So again, like any estate planner, I always stress to people, go in and have your will done. Just like your doctor say, go in and have your annual exam done. It's very, very important to do that. Somebody asked me, and I'll finish up with this, just a real quick tax issue. Taxes at the federal level right now for a husband and wife exceed $10 million. So there's really no reason to worry about taxation unless you really do have an outstanding collection. but we're at the $10 million level. And the only other thing I'll tell you, because we've been talking about gifts, there's a little rumor out there that your gifts are limited to $14,000 per year per donee. And that's true, but that's only part A of that particular rule. Most everybody knows that part of our tax code. They don't know part B, and I'll just share that with you. And part B says that you have a lifetime exclusion. Remember, the $14,000 is per year. That's part A. Part B is a lifetime exclusion, if you will, and right now it's at a little over $5 million. So what that means is if you have a $5 million collection out there and you want to give it away, there's not going to be any taxes on it, so it should not dissuade you. But again, I'm not going anywhere when it's over, and I'll be wandering around. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them for you. But again, thanks for attending. Thanks for listening to all of us. Appreciate it.
I want to thank our panel.